I got Jay Bilas on the podcast today discussing the NBA draft, the state of college basketball, and a lot else. And what I felt like was a pretty awesome conversation. Loved having Jay on. On Thursday, Tom Haverstraw and I are going to be back recapping what's been a very busy week in the NBA. Malone is heading to UNC. The Bulls fire their front office. Lots of injury news. Wemby, Lakers. Doc Rivers telling the Bucks to Google him. It's the most Doc Rivers story ever. I can't wait to talk about that with Tom. And we're going to talk about whatever else happens between now and then at 11:30 Eastern, live on YouTube on Thursday. But today, we got Jay Bilas on the show. Jay freaking Bilas. Let's go. Joining me now to talk about the NBA draft of college basketball, the legend from ESPN, Jay Bilas.
I don't know who you're talking about, but I got the Jay Bilas part. The rest was not true, but thank you.
A legend in my eyes. Been watching you, you know, as long as I can remember. Jay, appreciate you joining me today, man. So last night, we're recording this on Sunday, day after the Final Four, and I'm sitting, I had an amazing seat. I was close to you. I was behind Bill Raftery, and I was like, oh my God, this is the best seat in the house I could possibly ask for. Bill Raftery, you posted on X last week about his reaction to the UConn-Duke game. You said, Bill Raftery has the same exact reaction when he hears last call at any bar. What's your best night out story with Bill Raftery?
Oh God, there were so many of them. You know, Bill, I think you would find that every person that knows him, You could never find anybody to say a bad word about him. He's just the most joyful person to be around. And he's got a wonderful sense of humor, but he's just great. And when we work together doing all these Big Mondays and Big East tournament and all that stuff, I knew that I was going to pay a price for it the next morning after some of these nights out. But I told my wife one time, I go, look, if I come home and I'm a zombie, I'm not saying no to going out with Raft. It's going to be worth every minute of it. My favorite one was, I might not be a night out, but Sean McDonough and Bill and I worked together in a three-man booth doing Big Mondays. And Bill had been working with Vern Lundquist on a Saturday. And then we all met in Philadelphia for a Villanova game, big Monday game. And so we decided to have lunch before we went to practice and did the game that night. And so when we all got sat down, McDonough asked Bill, he says, you know, how was the weekend with CBS? You know, how's Vern? And Raf says, oh, it was great. You know, we went to dinner the night before and we had some wine and we talked about the business and we talked about all the great broadcasters. Your name didn't come up. And I spit my soup out. I was laughing so hard. Like the whole setup, it was like a professional comedian did it. But we've laughed about that ever since. Your name didn't come up. But there's nobody you'd rather be with in any setting than Raft.
Your impressions are pretty spot on. You've acted, right?
Yeah, but I mean, I hung out with those guys a lot, so their voices ring in my ears.
I can't do impressions of my friends that I hang out with all the time like that. You got a skill there, Jay.
Yeah. I mean, if there's ever any money to be made from a Bill Raftery impression, then I'll cash in.
He said he's not actually 82, but he's actually older than that. He just never corrected his birthday.
I don't even know how old he is. And
might be 120.
Yeah, I've never really thought about it. But he's so energetic. And the one of the many things that I love about him is, like, I think Bill loves basketball as much as anybody, but he loves the people in the game more than anybody. And there's never a place we go where he doesn't want to spend time with the coaches and the players and the trainers and all that. He's got time for everybody, but he seeks them out too. And it's a kind of a great lesson to enjoy what you're doing while you're doing it, because nobody has more fun in the day to day than he does.
You've played, you've coached, you've broadcasted for years. What do you love about basketball?
I love basketball from the first time I dribbled a ball. A lot of it comes from, you know, you could play it in any setting. You know, you play with your friends, you play one-on-one, you play two-on-two, all the way to five-on-five. And one of the things I love about it is You know, if you're going to play football, you know, they're going to put you in a position. You can only play half the game. You know, you don't play offense and defense. It's a specialization sport. It's great. I mean, clearly society loves it, but they don't have to play it. And I played baseball growing up, and I really enjoyed baseball, but there was a lot of boring stuff in baseball, a lot of standing around waiting. And basketball is something happening all the time. And I loved it. And I got, you know, got into it, and I started getting better and, you know, going through high school and then being able to play in college and play professionally overseas and all these different things, going through all these experiences, just all the relationships you had were a little bit different than anything else I'd ever done. And just being in it and around it, I enjoy, like, you know, it's a young man's game, so you can't play forever. Some of my friends, I'm 62, some of my friends still try to play. They play in pickup games, and they're all getting hurt and snap an Achilles or hurt their knee. And I'm like, what are you guys doing? So I don't play anymore, but I don't love it any less. And I've spent my whole life in and around it, and I just can't imagine anything I'd rather be a part of.
The game's changed so much over these decades that you've loved it. Mm-hmm. That hasn't impacted the way you perceive the game or love the game at all.
Oh, I love it more. And the game's better now. You know, it'd be like somebody, you know, I play a lot of golf now, but it'd be like somebody saying, boy, I really love the old Bellotta golf balls that didn't go as far as the new Titleist Pro V1s. You know, you'd be an idiot to say that. I don't know what in America doesn't get better over time. Like, our cars are better. Like, you may like a traditional car back in the day and a classic car or something. We can't argue that today's cars
didn't last long.
Yeah, they're better. They're more efficient. You know, everything is more comfortable. Everything's better about them. And basketball is better. The players are better. So, like, I think it's great when I get together with all my friends. We're the same age and we're having a drink or something. We can all talk amongst ourselves about how great we were and how great the game was back in the day. But, man, I would never say that in front of the current players because they're better. And doesn't mean that Michael Jordan wouldn't be the best player now or Oscar Robertson wouldn't be the best player now. But by and large, the players, the overall, the players are better than they've ever been. And the teams are better than they've ever been. And I can't imagine any football player in the NFL would think that the Green Bay Packers of the 60s could beat, you know, the current Super Bowl champions. That, to me, that would be ludicrous.
Probably couldn't beat the worst team in the league. The
probably
Oakland
not.
Or the Las Vegas
who
Raiders.
Knows? And yeah. Look, I'm not saying that if they had the same training methods and the same stuff, and the same rest and recovery, who cares? They didn't. You know, the game's evolved, and I think the game's better than it's ever been.
Why do you think the players he have improved so much over time? Is it just purely we're talking about strength and conditioning programs? Or what are the factors behind that?
I think it's across the board factors. They're spending more time playing. Their IQs are higher in the game. They've been coached better. They've been coached longer. I think the entire operation of certainly that's filtered down to high school. Like, high school coaching, I think, is better than it's ever been. And there's more put into it. There are more resources behind it. But just in college now, I mean, look at the staffs that these programs have and the facilities that they can use 24 hours a day with their nutrition and rest and recovery, you know, strength and conditioning. It's almost like, you know, you expect this because of all that's been put into it. And look, it's the province of old people like me to say, well, back in the day, we were better at this. We were tougher and we were strong. No, we weren't. We were not. It's great for us to say that. That's great. But if the stopwatch had never been invented, old people would say that Mark Spitz swam faster than Michael Phelps, and he did not. And I don't know why we like to do that, but like, guys my age, you know, we might say, hey, you know, the ACC was better back in the 80s. It was incredibly competitive. But we would never have entertained if somebody from the 60s came up and said, well, we were better than you guys. And so it's just like, you know, basketball started to decline after I played. You know, that's kind of silly.
You said in passing there about how you feel like the coaching is better at the high school levels. Well, sometimes you talk to NBA coaches and they say, oh, kids come in nowadays, they don't know how to play. They blame AAU and all that. It seems like you don't really subscribe to that now.
Because coaches have said players don't know how to play since man first came out of the, you know, out of the ooze. You know, when I was in high school, all of our coaches complained that we played too much pickup ball and we played too much. We didn't do enough drill work. We didn't do enough practice. We didn't dribble through cones enough. And now coaches complain that you're doing too much skill work. You're not playing 5-on-5. No cone can guard any of you guys. What are you doing? They're going to complain about everything. That's just the nature of this kind of thing. It's always better before, just like in recruiting. The high school coach has too much authority. And then AAU coaches start to get involved. And we got to get it back to the high school coaches. You know, the AAU coach has too much authority. Now it's agents. And now it's, you know, this. It's always something. And I don't know whether it's, I'm not a psychologist, but I don't know whether it's in our nature as human beings just to complain about the way things are. But there's never been a time when coaches thought players did exactly the right thing, because I've got a whole list of complaints that coaches had when I played. That now they're complaining about the opposite.
I mean, it sure seems like that's the case in everything. The movies were better. The music was better. Right. Everything was better back in my day, right?
Well, yeah. And to your point, like, you know, I think back nostalgically about some of the TV shows I watched growing up. And when our kids were little, both my wife and I said, they might see an old classic channel show. I said, hey, watch this. And it's great. This is my favorite show growing up. And we watched it and we thought it sucked now. And, you know, we have these memories about the way things were.
It's nostalgia. That's what it is.
It's nostalgia. And it's great. Like, all those things were great at the time, but things are better now. And you know, you'd think that coaches would be arguing about, you know, it's like them saying the rotary phone was better than your iPhone. No, it's not. And the iPhone's not going away. All these kids do is they look at their phones and they don't communicate anymore. These guys have great relationships now on teams. And so there's so much that's the same. Things are different, but I'm sure that you know, their parents complained about the music they listened to and you know, what they did that was different than what they did that wasn't the Ozzy and Harriet stuff. Mm. And yet the world still spins firmly on its axis. We're all going to be okay.
If there's a player, I mean, right now you have like a different generation of NBA fans. You have those NBA fans who preferred the game while it was played in the 90s, more post-ups, more mid-range, more so than the way it is nowadays. Is there a player in the NBA that you would recommend people would watch who kind of like threads together those eras that reminds you of past eras while playing in the current day?
Well, if people say they preferred the way Larry Bird played, then watch Nikola Jokic. And if you can't appreciate that guy's, if not the best player in the world, one of the three best players in the world, then I would argue you don't know what you're looking at. He's an artist. And, you know, I look back at some of these older games. I loved the competition and loved the game at every stage. But I prefer today's game over watching the games of the 90s. When you would turn on a finals game and there was a fair chance the score would be 89-84. I love today's game. And you could say the same thing about baseball. Maybe a baseball purist would say, you know, I preferred, you know, a walk, bunt the guy over. And, you know, I didn't prefer that, but at the time I loved it. But you watch the game now, it's fantastic. And just because, you know, Paul Skeens doesn't pitch 9 innings in every start, if Bob Gibson were pitching now, they would treat him the same way. He would be an asset that's worth too much to overuse. And it's just part of the thing now. Like, analytics are important. And the reason they use it is because it helps you win.
How should the NBA address exactly what you're hitting on with MLB with Paul Skeens, not pitching 9 innings? In the NBA, players sometimes aren't reaching 65 games. That's sort of the bar for a lot of guys nowadays, not playing the full 82. Steve Kerr talks about shortening the schedule. Some talk about slowing the game down or removing the 3-point line. What would you recommend as something to kind of solve these issues that the NBA currently is dealing with?
Well, I think you have to determine whether it's really a problem. You know, oftentimes people will say they don't like something and their viewing habits indicate that they do. So right now, as an example, you hear a lot of people say, you know, I'm turned away from college sports, man. I can't, I'm not interested in this and all that's going on. And I don't like NIL and I don't like the transfer portal, and ratings are higher than they've ever been. Now, how do you explain that? People say one thing, they do another. Look, would it be better for the NBA if everybody was trying to win every game all the time? Of course. But if you're trying to win a championship, like what we're asking is there going to be what they're calling load management in order that we're at our best when the championship is being contested? So it means maybe your best player doesn't play in this road game where we don't need him, so we can preserve him. We don't put him in a position to get injured, maybe like Luka Doncic did the other night, something like that. Those are valid concerns. The problem they have is the draft and tanking for the draft, because it works. And teams are going to do what works in order to get better and give themselves an opportunity to get a Victor Wembanyama or something like that. That is what needs to be addressed. Load management, to me, is not as big of an issue, and I'm not worried about that. And that's what I was talking about in sort of the Skeens Gibson example. But, you know, of course you don't want somebody buying tickets to a game and giving it to their kids for Christmas, and then the player they really want to see doesn't play. I mean, that's unfortunate. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that you can always help that particular thing, just like you can't help if the player gets hurt in the playoffs and the kids got tickets to it.
It can still happen. Yeah, then.
It's still going to happen. You know, those things can happen. The tanking is a different issue. And and I think the NBA understands that and they'll address it. But it's hard. It's
people I talk to sometimes in the league office, I'll say to them, well, why don't you guys shorten the schedule for 1 year and just as a trial? Like, maybe you take some losses, but maybe things dramatically improve and you find out, then you do it for another year and another year. It doesn't need to be something that's permanent. And the pushback that I often receive when I say something along those lines is, well, we worry if we change the schedule to 60 games and change, suddenly players playing 65 games will turn to the players playing 40 games. And I was like, well, you don't know until you try. If there's less games, every game is going to take on greater importance. You just need to try some things out when it comes to that. But that's a very complicated issue we're talking about when it comes to load management, amount of games. The tanking and intentionally losing that you're hitting on is definitely that's the number different. One issue.
Yeah.
And that's where the NBA seems very much focused right now when it comes to trying to address that. You have 10-ish teams right now who would rather lose on any given night rather mm-hmm. than win a game. Last week, the Kings beat the Pelicans in a game, and that was a terrible result for both teams. The Kings are better off losing to hold their spot in the lottery. The Pelicans don't even have their own draft pick. They're better off. There's no reason to lose. It shouldn't be the case that a Kings fan watching that game is like, ah, we won? This sucks. I can't get all excited about these great plays down the stretch. That is something that the NBA does need to address.
Yeah, it's a perverse incentive, and it's nobody's fault. Things evolve a certain way, and teams that are competing are going to figure some things out. I think the lottery overall is a good idea because, you know, look, there are problems with all this and potential problems. You want teams that aren't doing well to have the opportunity to get better. And that, so they're rewarded in a way for not doing as well to having a top pick in the draft. The NFL gives their worst record the number one pick, and there's no discussion. And I haven't studied it, so I don't really know why there's not a race to the bottom in that. Maybe there is, but
there is, but to like a lesser degree. Yes.
Yeah. A lesser degree.
In part because the nature of the sports with the NFL, it's 50 plus guys on rosters. One guy at the top of the draft doesn't necessarily change your fortunes in the way that one player can in basketball.
Yeah. And I'm not as concerned, and I respect Steve Kerr's opinion on this, and reasonable minds I think can differ. But, if you start messing with the 82 games, it'd be similar to saying, why don't we go from 48 minutes to 40? And then players are going, well, wait a minute now. That's going to mess with statistics, which, you know, you've had players that have been putting statistics up in a 48-minute game. Now you're going to be giving me 40.
And contracts, too.
And contracts.
A starter might still play 30, right. 35. What happens to role players?
Exactly. And it changes values. And so those things that have to be really thought about, because there are always things that you're gonna miss. You're gonna think it's gonna work out one way, and you're gonna miss it. People call it unintended consequences. I mean, you know, certainly things you don't think about can be unintended. But it's way more complicated. And I don't think you change something that's worked so well for so long without it being a necessity. And most of the time, you know, the MBA's decisions are usually data driven, and most of the decisions that have been made, if not the overwhelming majority, have been really good. Like, that's one of the complaints I've had about the NCAA over the years with all the different committees they have is, you know, and I'm speaking specifically on basketball, is like, why are we not adopting some of these MBA rules? Like, we finally in college put a challenge in, but we didn't combine the challenge with the appeal. And we're like, why don't we just take the MBA rule? It works great. And like, they've actually studied this and studied it more than we have. You know, but somehow you say, you know, NBA in one of these meetings, like, said the F word in church. Like, come on, man. They've got good rules. We should adopt some of them.
And we'll be right back after this break. Why do you think the NCAA and the NBA don't work more closely together with those types of decisions?
It's all the NCAA's fault. And when I say NCAA, I'm not talking about, you know, the president of the NCAA or all that. It's just there are so many committees, and there are committees in every sport, and there are way too many committees to run an organization efficiently that needs to make decisions that are contemporaneous with the issue that they're dealing
regulation.
With.
Essentially.
Well, yeah, I guess you'd call it that. But, you know, if you had a plumbing problem in your bathroom, you wouldn't want to form a committee and have a discussion over how you're going to deal with it and then make a ruling, and you decide every other year as to whether you're going to call a plumber. you'd want somebody in charge of maintenance that would just call the damn plumber. And that's sort of the way it works. And the rules committee in college basketball can only change the rules every other year. Like, that's stupid. Like, why would we hamstring ourselves? But I guess it comes from this thing of, well, we don't want to get in the mode of changing things too quickly. But, you know, there are certain things that we can do, but there's an old school, I don't know the right way to put it without being insulting, but it's almost like there's this old school mentality of, we have to differentiate the college game from the pro game. It's already differentiated. It's differentiated by the players go to college. That's the differentiation. Whether they get paid or not, it's different from the NBA, and it's different from FIBA. But the play on the floor doesn't have to be different. The rules don't have to be different. Like, college basketball, men's college basketball, is literally the only game in the world that does not have quarters. And you're like, why? You can reset team fouls at the end of the first and third quarter. So if you have a team that picks up some early fouls, they're not saddled with those fouls for the entire half, and it's not going to be as big of an effect on the game. Fewer free throws on common fouls throughout the course of the game if they're reset. It's a better way to do it. And we're the only ones that won't do it.
You mentioned how you think it's more the NCAA's fault. I'm sure if you talk to some college coaches, they'd say, well, the NBA, they invested in the G League Ignite, and they supported Overtime Elite. They're not supporting us. They're trying to have their own system. They have issues with the way the NBA handles things. They have issues with the early entry deadline when it comes to waiting around now with the transfer portal, having to wait, you know, 5 weeks until the players have to make their decisions. Is there anything on the NBA side that you think perhaps should change to kind of appease some of those college coaches now?
No, because the NBA is running their own business. And I'm talking about college, the NCAA running its own business. There's like, the NBA could very well feel right now that, wait a minute, when you guys passed NIL rules, that's affected our second round now. More prospects that would have come to us. Like, our second round is not as valuable as it used to be. You know, what would you think if you were the NCAA? You'd think tough. You know, we got, I mean, sorry, but we got to do what's best for us. You know, I think there could always be better cooperation, because ultimately the best players that play in college are going to be the best players that play in the NBA at some point. So could there be a better relationship and making the entire whole better? Of course there could, but the NBA is not the problem. You know, college needs to run its business, and you know, what can the NBA do to make college have quarters? You know, that's college's decision, and that's the NCAA's decision. And again, it's not the entire sort of monolith of the NCAA that I'm talking about. It's the rules committee. And they'll tell you right now, people that are in charge of this side of it will say there are too many, it's just too much commercial inventory to be able to do it. I don't buy that. I think there are certainly ways we could do it. It would make the game better, and I don't see why not. But you know, similar to what we were talking about before, like you go from 48 to 40 minutes. That's a big change. And there are people in college over the years on these committees, and I was on the competition committee for a while, that would say, and the Jaden Bradley game last night for Arizona was an example. So Jaden Bradley gets in foul trouble. That was a factor in Arizona getting beat as bad as they did. So maybe we should go to six fouls. Fair point. My thing would be, no, it's six fouls in the NBA, but they play a 48-minute game. And it's five fouls in college. It's one foul per 8 minutes in each game.
Yeah.
So what are we doing here?
Literally the same.
It's the same.
Yep.
So I wouldn't be in favor of it. And, you know, so if you start doing that, then you'd probably really want to look at data and saying, all right, if we gave six fouls in 40 minutes, would that lead to more fouling and therefore slow games down a little bit more? And would coaches, they're going to use it strategically to their advantage. So what effect would that have? Because at the end of the day, this is a game. It's a game for the players, but it's also a game for the fans. And the fans have to be able to consume it in the best possible way. And that's got to be a factor. It may not be the deciding factor, but I can tell you, Kevin, one of the things that drove me crazy is when old men like me would say, well, we need to get this out of our game, and say, they would say our game, not our game. It is not our game. It's not old people's games. It's the players' game. They're the ones that are playing. It's their game. Now, there's certainly things that need to be managed around it. It's a product that's being sold, and it's being sold for billions of dollars, and that matters. But that sort of ownership feeling when people who were administrating would say, we got to get this out of our game. Our game. God, I hate that. That always bothered me.
I mean, it's like you said, it's the players' games. It's really a young person's game. The players on the court. It's like, I always appreciate when a coach does say, well, coach's coach, players play. You know, I'm nothing without, like, I think at the Basketball Hall of Fame presser, basically every coach up there on that stage said the same thing. I'm not here if it's not for the players.
Yeah, that's what they say then, but they don't say that in practice.
No, exactly. No, not at all.
In practice, everything exists.
You're nothing without me.
It's me.
Yeah. Well, Danny Hurley will say it in front of the players anytime and in front of the microphones. I mean, Hurley, the legend, will continue to grow depending on what happens on Monday night against Michigan. You mentioned the players, like, you know, it's for the fans, and that makes me think of NIL. On one hand, with that NIL and the transfer portal, you get players changing teams every year. You look at Stojakovic for Illinois after losing on Saturday at Stanford. It's Cal. It's Illinois. We'll see if he stays with Illinois. I would imagine he will after their success and his success this year. But on the other hand, for fans, it's like, well, you can't become attached to some of these guys. If you're a mid-major, you have a really good player, you can lose that guy. It's beneficial for players. They get to go to more winning situations. Adai Mara being a great example of that, going from UCLA to Michigan. I think at the end of the day, there's pros and cons for a fan. From an NBA perspective, you mentioned how sometimes the NBA might say, well, you're hurting our second round. But every time I talk to league executives, they say, we like when guys stay longer in school. You get more exposure, more development. That's not, you know, we're not having to pay for that development. Guys come out more ready. And I think Adaimar is one of the best examples of that in this year's draft. He entered UCLA as a projected top 10 pick as a Spanish center. He really struggled as a freshman. He struggled at the start of his sophomore year before really coming on late. And then this year as a junior with Michigan, he was amazing. He was incredible. To me, he's a great example of the incentive that NIL now provides to stay in school. And it's good for the NBA that a guy can get those 3 years of development before entering the NBA. What do you think about Adaimar and his development over these 3 years in college basketball and what that means for him moving forward in the NBA?
It's great, but it's great in all these different iterations of it. And look, I know it's more complicated than this, but if the NBA really believed that 3 years was the best thing, they'd make every player stay 3 years because they could do that. The NFL does that. And the NFL actually made them stay 4 years for a long time until the USFL started drafting juniors. Then they started drafting juniors. That's how that worked. But, you know, the NBA, they want LeBron as soon as possible. They want the supernovas as soon as possible. Other players, they want them older so they can help. Guys that are going to be rotational players, maybe starters, but aren't the
Lindenborg types.
Yeah, maybe not the true superstars. So there are layers to this. But yeah, I think it's better for everybody the longer. I think generally speaking, I would rather have a young adult in school longer because I think it's better for everyone. That may not be true of every person. You know, there are some that are super geniuses that need to go. You know, would it be better for, you know, Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg to stay in school longer? I mean, I don't know the answer to that. But generally, I think for the overwhelming majority of students, it's better for them to stay in school longer. And I think that's true of athletes, too. But to your point on a fan saying, well, you know, they're bouncing around from place to place and I can't watch them. Why are the ratings up if you can't watch them?
Higher than ever.
Higher than ever. And you know, I think sometimes people say that they loved it, but, you know, think about Elliot Cadeau for a second. Like, so he was at North Carolina for the first couple of years of his career. He had a really good high school career, coveted recruit. And he led North Carolina in assists his first 2 years. And Carolina fans complained about him a lot. And now they want him back. But when he transferred, there weren't as many people crying as you think, or as some people may think. And that's sort of the thing. Like, people say they liked it. They like them to stick around. But some players, they stick around. The fans get tired of them. And the players feel that. And when they're coveted somewhere else, they can go. And it's also changed in the coaching thing. Like, when I played, the coach said, my way, the highway. And they knew there was no highway. You know, now they say my way, the highway. There's a highway right there, a highway right there, and there's more money on that highway. So not only do I not have to listen to this, I get that. And there are positives and negatives to the portal. The players didn't create the portal. No judge told the NCAA, ordered the NCAA to put the portal in. The NCAA did it on their own. Like, they created the portal. And now some of them don't. Now the coaches don't like it. They created it. But, you know, Yaxel Lindenborg, you know, went to junior college and then went to UAB. Is he required to stay at UAB just because he was a late developer or wasn't recognized to be the great player he is? He's not allowed to go to a better stage. And, you know, just because we had a transfer restriction for all those years doesn't mean it was right. And to me, if you want your players to stay, one, treat them better and they'll stay. Number two would be sign them to long-term contracts where it's their choice to be locked in. But the NCAA didn't want to do that. And until they run this business like the multi-billion dollar entertainment industry it is, they're going to have to live with this. And no executive order is going to stop it.
And you tend to be on the side that you think the players should be more employees rather than
No, I'm not there. What I think should happen. So there are a number of different tracks of this, but to me, the NCAA should just say, hey, we're going to be in charge of competition. You guys pay or not pay, however you want. Like, the NCAA has no rules for how schools pay their coaches. Not one. You know, so they're not saying you have to sign and do a certain amount of certain years on the contract. The buyouts have to be a certain amount or can't be over this amount. That's an arm's length transaction between each school and each coach. And there's no body out there that tells universities, all right, you all have to have hospitals and you have to staff them a certain way. Do that and tell them what to teach and how to teach it. But man, they tell them everything they need to do with players, and it's illegal. And that was proven in multiple court cases, including, you know, the Alston case before the Supreme Court and the House case that they settled and paid former players $2.8 billion. And they have settlement things. And now they have to allow $20.5 million in revenue sharing plus NIL. The NCAA agreed to that, so they didn't get slammed with more. My thing is, schools should be allowed to contract with players how they want. If they want to be employees, great. If they don't, that's fine. I'm not saying any school should be required to pay anybody. If you want to have volunteer coaching staffs, do it. If you want to have unpaid players, do it and see how it works out for you. I don't think it'll work out very well. I mean, I don't think you'll win a lot of games, but see how it works out for you if you want to do it that way. If Congress wants to get involved, don't think it's not my preference. I don't think it's the right thing for Congress to be doing when they've got bigger fish to fry.
And it seems like they do want to be involved.
Well, yes and no. Congress hasn't acted yet. Yes. You've got individual legislators that have put forth legislation and gone anywhere. Nothing's been passed. So they may want, some may want to get involved, but as a legislative body, they haven't done anything. So, you know, like, and what would be the incentive for a legislator for an industry that is wearing out the tires, driving to the bank with bigger checks to cash and stands full, ratings higher than ever? What's the incentive? Like, what's broken? It's just a lot of coaches complaining, a lot of administrators complaining, but I'd like to know what's broken. And when you hear the word unsustainable, but nobody thinks it's unsustainable for coaches to make this much, and it's not unsustainable for LSU. What's LSU paying in buyouts to their coaches in the last few years? Like $70-80 million.
Wow.
And God, they fired Brian Kelly.
Yeah. Yeah,
and they had to pay Kelly's buyout to get Kelly. Then they got to pay him a buyout to fire him. Then they got to pay Lane Kiffin's buyout to get him.
It's crazy.
And all that stuff. And then they fire Matt McMahon. They pay his buyout to fire him. And they got to pay Will Wade's buyout to get him back. And we're worried about what some guy's getting in NIL. And when somebody says, hey, it's going to cost $12 million for this team's roster, the coaches make more than that. You look at what it costs to pay the staff, and you think the staff is more valuable than the players. Like, it's kind of laughable when you really think about it. But we've got this old school mentality of like, wait a minute, 5 years ago, it wasn't like this. And forever, we would ask a player, hey, where'd you get that watch? Who gave you that necklace?
How'd you get that car?
Yeah. Like, can you imagine that? At least we don't have to do that crap anymore.
No more dropping bags of cash to the passenger window.
But you know what, Kevin? Like, the one thing...
Well, that still might happen, so...
The one thing that you try to explain to people, because some of them don't really care. They may talk about it with you and me because we're in it all the time. And so it may be a nice conversation over a drink or at a cocktail party or something. But... If for some, like, coaches love to say it's transactional now. It's transactional before. You made them sign a letter of intent and scholarship papers and all that, and they were locked in. That's a transaction. And when they were locked in for that amount of time, it didn't mean they were loyal. It meant they couldn't go. Like, loyalty didn't just go like that. Like, these kids are different. They always call them kids to infantilize them when it's called men's college basketball. But loyalty didn't just go away. They got opportunities now, and nobody says the coaches are disloyal and all that when they're jumping from job to job whenever it suits them. And that's great. They should be allowed to do that if they want to. But the players, I think the rhetoric around the players is unfair to them, but you see it every bit as much, if not more, than I do. every game lost in this NCAA tournament, players cry in the locker room. You know, they talk about how much they love each other and they cry on the podium because the season's over or maybe their career's over with these guys. And that ain't transactional. And that's the same. It's the same as it was when I played. It's the same as it was 10 years ago. This stuff is meaningful. And whether, like, how can the coaches have relationships and make all this money and somehow the players can't do it? I mean, it's just, none of it makes any sense. And we need to stop. I think we need to stop, you know, talking like we talk and just start treating this like the business it is.
Which is why you want to have players have contracts with buyouts to retain that optionality. But give it a bit more structure. If they want those.
If they want it.
If they want it. Yes.
You know, so say the two of us are being recruited.
Yeah.
And you're a top prospect that could be a lottery pick this year. And I'm more the guy that, hey, you know, I'm going to be in school for a while. And if it works out for me, great. I'll sign the 4-year deal. And you'll go, I'll give you a year with an option for a second.
Yeah.
You know, because you want to keep your options open. So maybe you get paid a little bit less than you would have gotten otherwise, but it's worth it to you because to keep that option. So we negotiate differently. And then what? We're not going to be friends on the same team because your deal is different than mine? Because that's what some of the coaches used to say. They said, oh man, we start paying them. We're going to have fights in the locker room and all that.
Not a chance.
I said, who's breaking up the fights in your coaches' meetings? Because you guys are all paid something different, right? It was so silly. And we just kind of need to lose some of these silly arguments. And I think some of the coaches that are talking need to start reading the rules because I'm not sure they know them.
We'll be right back. You had a debate with Coach John Calipari over the weekend during the Final Four, and conversation. I mean, he seems to be more in the camp that you're kind of describing, like adding structure here. And he used the word, I believe, Fugazi money. That could disappear for some of these guys who are getting paid in college and then they graduate and they're not pros in the NBA, they're not pros in the G League, they're not pros overseas, and they graduate and they go from making, you know, $1 million or $800,000 to $60,000 and the difficulty for that for some of those players. Is that just a risk you accept? That's just part of it. You made big money and now is a different time of your life, a different stage.
I don't even understand that argument. So for the players' best interests, like we don't want anybody to feel bad if they go from making more money in their life to less. So let's not pay them what they're worth so they have nothing. And then whatever they get, it's a jump up and they'll feel better. That's absurd.
I agree.
That's an absurd thing.
Zero sense.
It's an absurd thing to say out loud. Now I understand, like, you know, we could argue about mental health for a lot of different reasons. You know, with all that you have coming at you and, players now see all this stuff on social media, you know, so they miss a shot in a game and all of a sudden they're getting this stuff that I didn't have to deal with. We had newspapers and talk radio and that was it. So we didn't have the same kind of challenges.
It's getting sent to your family now,
right?
Your sister, your girlfriend.
Those are
your
real
buddies,
things.
Everything.
Those are real things. I don't, and I'm not a psychologist or psychiatrist. I have no training in this. I find it hard to believe that being paid $1 million to play basketball and then when basketball's over, having to go out and get a job and making less is going to be more taxing on my mental health than making nothing while the people around me are benefiting and then going out and getting the same job. Because you see it too. So many of these players, and maybe not everyone, but so many of these players are making really good decisions with their money. I mean, Seth Drimble at University of North Carolina bought a Ben & Jerry's franchise. He's an owner-operator of Ben & Jerry's franchise.
Wow,
that's pretty good leg up for him. Yeah. Where before, you know, if he went into a Ben & Jerry's and they gave him a free cone, he would have been ineligible. How's that for your mental health? Like, you know, but that's true. And it's that kind of thing that people aren't thinking about. And I get it. Like, you go from zero to now the players are able to make something which is nowhere near their value. And people are going, wait, this is different. I don't like this. I mean, I don't, you know, but if it's their kid, like if their child was an expert musician and could cut a record while they were in college, and all the colleges said, look, we're going to give these people music scholarships, and they're going to play in our bands, and our bands are going to make money, and we're going to keep the money because they're just in training now. They'd go nuts. And it's no different with basketball, because people are benefiting to the tune of millions of dollars off these players, and they got zero for all these years. And that was wrong to the point of being immoral. And now at least we're on the track to it being fair.
I think you hit the nail on the head there, Jay. I mean, I 100% agree with you. I mean, look, you could have, like, these kids who are making this money should or can be pushed towards taking money management classes, watching money management stuff on YouTube. You don't even need to take a class nowadays. But learning that and pushing kids towards that, that's also on a coach. If you know a guy's making $250,000 or $2.5 million, a coach can take that responsibility and say, hey, here's some YouTube videos to watch. Here's a book to read. And here's something you can do so you can make this money last forever and grow it into something that lasts hopefully for generations. But not the taking that away from them because of some concerns of the mental health aspect, I think it's just absolutely ridiculous.
It's absurd. And to your point, in a college environment, university environment, there's so many people that are resources for any student,
especially for an athlete. Yes.
So if you had a contract offer to do a commercial for State Farm or whatever, if you took that over to the law school and asked one of the law professors to help you with it, they'd do it in 2 seconds. They'd absolutely do it.
And they'd be happy. They'd love teachers love when a student asks for help.
Yes. And so in that environment, it's great. And look at the educational aspects of that you have all these young people, the financial literacy is jumping, you know, I don't know to what multiple. When I graduated from college, we weren't allowed to work. We weren't allowed to do anything. We were policed. And when I signed my first contract to play professionally overseas, I had no idea what to do with my money. You know, I had to get help from my father to invest it and what to do with it. And, you know, I was lucky I had that. But now these young people, and to your point, even if they blow it, Aren't they better off for the experience of having done that? and there are so few of them that we're even dealing with that issue. So there's always, you know, sort of the opportunity to say, well, what about this negative consequence? What about that? The positives outweigh that. And I joked with a coaching buddy of mine who used to say, you know, look at all the problems going to happen for this. They're going to do this. They're going to blow their money. They're all these different things. And I told him, I go, look, if players couldn't drive until now and the NCAA all of a sudden said you could drive, I'm pretty sure you would say, what's going to happen now? You know, they're not going to keep their license up. They're going to let their insurance lapse and they're going to have maintenance problems with the car and they could get into an accident or have a DUI. All those things could happen. That's true. But the overwhelming majority of people their age drive and do just fine. And it's the same thing with the money.
Before you go, Jay, I want to ask you a couple questions about some draft prospects. Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit about Adeyemar earlier. Are you surprised Adeyemar is not getting more top 10 hype?
No, because the class, first of all, like all the hype is just that. So what I think we're going to see, I can almost guarantee we're going to see a very different draft than is slotted right now. And probably in 10 years, we're going to look back and say, what were those guys thinking? How could they have slotted it this way? Because just about every draft works that way.
Every draft.
Yeah.
A single draft is perfect.
Yeah. It's hard. Like, yeah. How do you, you know, these NBA GMs and presidents and decision makers, like they spend a lot of time. They're smart people. Nobody's got this knocked. So I'm not surprised. But one of the reasons I'm not surprised is because this freshman class, as you know, is deeper in talent, in quality talent of anyone that I can remember. Now, maybe there are other ones out there and I'm not sitting there cataloging, you know, this is the best since 2003. I don't do that, but I can't remember it. And it certainly made an impact, I think, on everyone who's watched the game, gone, the quality of these freshmen and how deep it goes, you know, whether it's, you know, you get down the list and you're going, Hannes Steinbeck at Washington, or these guys, like, I don't remember guys that far down our list considering to be as good as I think that kid is. So, you know, Mara's going to help somebody. And whether he, you know, if he decides to come out, there's always the decision, you know, this year being so deep in prospects, maybe for some players, I'm not saying Mara or anyone in particular, they'll decide, you know what, I can work on my game, come back, make a bunch of money in college, have a good experience, and then go when I feel like I'm better prepared and there's not this log jam and I can be a higher pick next year. You know, that we're going to see some players do that where years ago they didn't. They needed to get out as soon as they could.
I mean, how beneficial was it to LeBaron Filon 1 year ago? He tests the waters with the draft, goes back to Alabama, doubles his points per game, proves his three-point jumper, becomes a more complete point guard with the opportunity and the year of development there. And now he's, you know, borderline lottery pick instead of late first, early second round pick, as he was, got the feedback last year entering the draft. I think
but that's the hard part, yes. Because there are a number of players we can point to that have left college before we thought they were ready. Like, it's not like the NBA and the G League are bad places to develop. It's just a question of what you think is best for each individual.
Yes.
Because sometimes, like, this is just my perspective. I think it's best to be in college because of one, how you're treated. Like, you know, you're going to travel better than you do in the G League. You're going to eat better by and large. And you're going to hopefully get better educated. Like, that's a good thing. And everybody,
and you live with kids your age, like you get to be 19 years old.
It's all good. Like, I think it's all good, but it's not the only thing. And having the door open for certain people, if they think it's better for them, and it may be, I'm good with it. Like, I don't ever second guess people's decisions. I may see it a different way, but it's worked out in every way we can catalog here for certain players.
I think there's a chance there could be surprises. Like, I mean, I think about Keaton Wagler. In all likelihood, he declares for the draft. In all likelihood, he's a top 10 pick. But there's an argument to be made that you were an unexpected one-and-done candidate. You have this great year at Illinois. You go to a Final Four. You lose. And, oh, wait a minute. Next year's 2027 draft class looks a lot weaker on paper. I could go back and try to make a run and try to win the national title, have a lot of these same guys back next year. We'll be even better next year. And I could be the number one pick a year from now as a sophomore. I think, like, there's at least going to be a surprise or two, I'd imagine, with some of the players that are projected in the top 20.
Of course. Now. As far as coming back.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. And you know, with some of them being so young. And it's not, I get your point about the surprise part. It's not just the surprise. I think it's got to be whether the individual feels like they're ready physically, emotionally, socially, all that. I think it's all balled up into one. And so if I'm advising any young person like I would, you know, my son or a family member or close family friend, you know, you would ask, all right, what's the rush? And if you have to think about it this long, isn't the answer no? Like, because the player should know if they're raring to go and all that, you know, you might want to even pull back a little bit and say, all right, hold on a second. Whoa, let's think about this before you dive in head first. But if the player is reticent about it all, you know, I say that to people a lot. If you have to think about it this much, isn't the answer no?
You mentioned on a podcast recently or something on ESPN how you're surprised about the lack of conversation for Darius Acuff to be a number one pick. Mm-hmm. What is the argument for Darius Acuff to be number one?
He's a walking bucket. Like the way he scores and how tough he is. You know, he's got those chest down drives. Like he's built differently than Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, but like those chest down drives that those guys get, it reminded me a little bit of him. But, you know, you watch him in person and you're like, my God, like, who's going to stop this guy? You know, he's scoring in the 30s, the 40s. And, you know, it's just a stat. But, you know, the first player to lead the SEC in scoring and assists since Maravich did it. That's pretty.
Wow.
That stands out. And there, you know, in the SEC tournament, I mean, he was not good. He was great. And you're thinking, how high is this ceiling going to be? And he's really competitive because he was hurt. Like, he played the whole year, not the whole year. He played most of the year injured. And, you know, he'd be in a boot during the week and then not really able to practice that much. And then he, you know, plays his tail off in the games. Really, really impressive. But there are a whole bunch of those guys, like Caleb Wilson in North Carolina. He gives you the feeling that he's just scratching the surface of how good he's going to be. And, you know, I'm a big believer and fan of his. And your point on Wagler, like, when I watch him, I kind of see Tyrese Halliburton. And I was a big believer in Halliburton when he came out. I thought he should have been a top three pick. Certainly, and look, everything's worked out for him. He's a good, but very similar players where you're not necessarily wowed by their athleticism, but you can't speed them up. And you sit and go, well, it's pretty low release on that shot. He gets it off great. Like, nobody's blocking it. And he makes great decisions. He's got a maturity level that's way beyond his years. You're just going, okay, nobody's got a crystal ball to see how it's going to be in the future. So we're going to make mistakes on all this stuff.
And that's where I think teams right now, or early April at this point, the draft combine will be in May. Teams are going to want more clarity on Darren Peterson, not because of Peterson concerns individually, it's the potential of those other guys you're mentioning, a Caleb Wilson, a Keaton Wagler, Darius Akeffor. So, like, if you feel like you're going to take on this risk with Darren Peterson or have a lack of certainty with his health and the cramping issue, you might favor somebody else who is also an unbelievable prospect who, even if Peterson were healthy, 10 years from now, Keaton Wagler could end up a star. Caleb Wilson could start tapping into his jumper, showing the flashes that we saw early in the season against Kansas and in other games against Duke as well, where the shot comes along and he becomes this complete basketball player. Darius Acuff becomes the new Kyrie Irving / Jamal Murray, whatever your comp is for him. There's a chance, like, those guys end up better anyway. But I think that's why for teams right now around the league, there's no guarantee Peterson's in the top three until we get more clarity on his medical.
There's no guarantee on anybody. But, like, I think that's a great point. Like, if really whatever pick you have, you have to make sure you get value out of that pick. You know, I haven't done any research on this, but my sense is that you're not going to get fired based upon, you know, in 10 years from now, the eighth pick wound up being better than the third pick. As long as the third, when you make that pick at three, as long as that one doesn't fail, you know, you get fired when the high pick fails, and you totally miss. Like, but there's part of it that I've looked back on this. I've been doing the draft since 2003 for ESPN, and it's amazing how I probably felt like I was more definitive in my opinions back then than I do now. And I think it's because I'm more experienced now and I know I don't know. my beliefs, you know, I'm not as, can't trust all this stuff. But in 2007, Greg Oden was the number one pick out of Ohio State. I don't know that it would have been unanimous, but my sense is that the overwhelming majority of teams in the league would have taken him number one over Kevin Durant. Because the league was different back then. And he gets hurt. And it's a, you know, now he's looked upon. He was not a bust. He got hurt. That guy, if he stayed healthy, he would have been terrific. You know, but you miss on Darko Milicic or something in 2003. And this stuff's hard. How many passed on Jokic when he was in the draft?
41, yeah. 41st pick, I believe. Mean, yeah, during a Taco Bell commercial.
Yeah, they're all the you had every team in the league passed on him at least once. And, you know, sometimes you just don't know. But it's an awesome process. I love doing it. But I wouldn't want to be, I wouldn't want to be tagged with all the mistakes I've had.
You wouldn't want to be a GM someday? If I, you wouldn't want to do that?
Oh yeah, it'd be great. But like the roles are so different. So, and just, I'm talking about the draft, obviously the jobs are different, but I have to, whoever, whenever we're doing draft analysis, we got to opine on all 30 players in the first round. Right. So our opinions on every player out there, a team drafts, they've got opinions on all those players, but they're only stuck with the ones they draft. So they could have the wrong opinion on, on 10 of them and nobody ever knows it. As long as they hit on the ones they draft, they're okay.
It's always funny when you talk to people in the league and they're like, I love that guy. And you're like, you knew, like you talked to them before the draft, they did love that guy, but they didn't take that guy. It's just the way it goes sometimes.
Yeah. And I don't, you know, it's funny. Like I don't take things that people say too seriously before the draft because it's not in their
smoke screens.
It's not in their interest to tell you what they're thinking. And I wouldn't do it if I were them.
Oh, I'd be lying through my teeth if I were a GM all the time.
So when I first started, I probably talked to people more. I don't now. Like I just scout them myself.
Because you know they're all lying.
Yeah. No, not all of them. I mean, part of it was I didn't want to be an information broker either. But I don't mind. People can ask me anything you want. But I'm the same way. I love talking. I love learning about like what people think's important, and what the, you know, kind of when you're evaluating, what people have said. Hey, don't get, like, I remember a friend of mine used to say, don't get seduced by athleticism. It's important, but it's not the be all and end all. And now, like, I think I'm fascinated by, like, I think there's so many great, you know, GMs and presidents, whatever their titles are. But, you know, obviously Sam Presti with the Thunder does an amazing job. But the character piece is really interesting to me, that, you know, you can't have character only. You know, you guys got to be able to play, but you can't have talent without the character in order to really, really be successful in that league. And just how they evaluate that and how important that is to a winning organization. Cause I mean, that's been a cornerstone for Oklahoma City and certainly been successful for
them. See it with the way those guys rally around each other after games. Awesome. It's part of it. And, you know, the Spurs are taking that on. It's part of winning culture. Some of these best teams, they all really love each other. Jay, thank you so much for joining me today, man. It's an honor to have you on the show.
Honored to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Jay. Big thank you to Jay Billis for joining me on today's episode. Truly an honor to have him on the podcast. As I said to him, that guy is a legend. I've been watching him on TV for as long as I can remember. And I think he is one of the brightest and smartest people covering basketball. And on top of that, he's enthusiastic about it. And it was really, really great to sit down with him for an hour. And hopefully we can get him on again. Would love to have Jay on again anytime he wants to join. Big thank you to Jay again. Thank you to Emmy for producing today's episode. Thanks to everybody for giving us a listen. As always, we will be back on Thursday with Tom Haverstraw catching up on very busy week in the NBA. Doc Rivers, Google me, Michael Malone to UNC, Bulls firing their front office, tons of injury news. I can't wait. Have a good day, everybody.